Well, thank you. It is good to be with you. I was asked back in 2009. I had a phone call from a very prominent scientist teaching at Baylor University, a Christian fellow, who asked me to do a presentation at a meeting of the American Scientific Affiliation. That's Christians in the sciences. That's what that association is for. And they were having a forum in their summer meeting on a historical Adam. And I've insisted on phrasing it as historical Adam and Eve, because, as you know, honor your father and your mother is the biblical principle. But I thought at the time that it would be sort of a simple discussion. I would simply rehash things that I had done in my commentary and my book on science and faith as well. But it wasn't to be that way. I was to be the voice of traditionalism in this forum, and they had two fellows from the theology department at Calvin College who were to be the no Adam guys. And you have to ask, okay, so why does a person begin even to ask this kind of question? I mean, we're Christians. The Bible talks about Adam and Eve, and that should settle it, right? And then if you need to, you go to Romans chapter 5. You have Adam sinned. We fell in Adam. You have Christ doing what he did on our behalf. So that should be a fairly simple conversation. Now, I'm sympathetic with that argument, okay, so don't hear what I'm not saying here. But not everybody sees it that way. And if you're going to engage in a discussion, you have to decide whether you're simply going to assert your position or you're actually going to try to go over to the person that you're talking to and understand why they come from where they do and bring them along. I prefer to do it that way. That is what I perceive to be my calling. It's just like in evangelism. You can choose. You can stand where you are and tell people, you come here to where I am, or you can go to where they are and help them to come along. So that's just to understand where I'm coming from and why I do what I do. The reasons why people have come to reopen this question, there are at least three. There are three primary reasons, I think. First of all, is just the fact that whatever we might say about human origins, it's a long time ago. And I don't care where you stand on the issue of the age of the earth, it's still a long time ago. It's natural for us as Westerners to ask, okay, so somebody did something, suppose this person existed, okay, suppose, and then they did something long ago in some other place, why does that have any bearing on me? I mean, who cares? That's the sort of argument you can find all through the history of humankind, not just in the 21st century. The things that bring it to the table are two. First, Dr. Rayburn just mentioned biology. There are various developments in biology, particularly with the Human Genome Project, which made its report in 2000. Was headed by a man named Francis Collins, who's not a relative of mine so far as I know, unless we go back to Adam, I guess. But I have actually said that to him, by the way. He was the head of the Human Genome Project. He's also a Christian, and he's written his testimony in a book called The Language of God. And he was deeply moved by the writings of C.S. Lewis and by his interactions with patients that he dealt with in the course of his medical training. One of the things that you see as a result of the, at least people say that they see, okay, so I'm not an expert in the genome, not by any stretch of the imagination, they say that they see evidence of two things. One of them is more serious than the other. One is that there are features of our genome that indicate that we share ancestry with the chimpanzees, various genes and non-broken copies of genes and so forth. I mean, that's the argument. And so the idea of God creating directly from the dust seems to be off the table, at least as far as it relates to the DNA evidence. Benjamin Warfield had already talked about things like that, so if you need us to discuss that later, I'm happy to. That's not as difficult as the one that is actually more telling and more prominent, namely that based on what we see in the human genome, it is hard to imagine the initial human population of being just two. And in fact, in evolutionary biology, it's really hard to talk about the first members of a species anyhow. You talk about a population and a gene pool and so on and so forth. And so Francis Collins embraces that and says, therefore, you know, we can't deal with the traditional story of Adam and Eve. So that's the one side, the biology. The other is the study of the ancient Near East. There really should be no reason to dispute. I mean, people do dispute this, okay? So, but they shouldn't. The stuff that you find, particularly in Genesis 1 through 11, has a relationship with other ancient stories of where the world came from, other ancient stories of the flood and so forth. I mean, those stories are not unique to the Bible. Now, the way that they're told in the Bible, that's unique, and we count that as sacred scripture, but it's widely regarded that what we have in Genesis 1 through 11 is an alternative story to the one that you find elsewhere. But, of course, these other stories are often called myths. That's the word that's usually used for them. And when we say something's a myth, in common usage, we mean that it didn't happen. I think in Richard Lederer's book, Anguished English, some student described a fairy tale as something that never happened a long time ago. I mean, that's that's what we usually think of when we say the word myth. And so, since here's the argument, since Genesis is like those things, why should we think that Genesis is any different from those other things, including in its mythical status? So those are the factors that bring the discussion into the current day. And so I realized that simply saying, well, the Bible says it, that settles it, is not going to be good enough. And actually, I want to say, quite frankly, that if a theologian comes to you and tells you the Bible clearly says, you need to have a little alarm bell going off in your head. You read the Bible to be saying, and here's why my reading is the one you should follow. That's how a person treats the whole endeavor responsibly. That's how a person shows you respect. We have the Bible, but we read the Bible. And so as we read it, we're interpreting. I mean, the same is true of the sciences. But, you know, sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander in that whole endeavor. You can't simply say, well, the Bible says this. You want to show why this reading of the Bible is a good one. And is the one that others should follow. So my approach was to ask, okay, so where do the stuff you have in Genesis 1 through 11, where does it fit in the biblical story? It's the front end of the biblical story, but why should that matter? There's a commentator, highly regarded commentator on Romans, who looks at Romans 5, and you have Adam and Christ being compared in Romans chapter 5. And according to that commentator, it's simply a comparison, just like you might compare Andrew here and Frodo. So it's not required for the comparison that Frodo be an actual human being. That's his argument. I didn't say it's a good one. I just, I have to clarify. Part of what I try to do is to be really fair to other people, and that often, if you're not used to that, okay, you think I'm endorsing what another view is when I'm just trying to be fair to it. Okay, so you can find this on the internet if you want to look, which I don't encourage you to do. But he will say it's a simple comparison, but as a matter of fact, what I argue is that it's actually a narrative type of comparison, namely somebody did something, and as a result, something happened. And then other things happened, and then Jesus came and died, and as a result, other things happened. So there's a whole structure to the narrative there in Romans 5. So a simple comparison in Romans 5 is not adequate to describe what we have going on there. But I've mentioned then the biblical story. What does the biblical story do? The biblical story gives you the explanation for why the world is the way that it is. And it invites you in to be a participant in the unfolding of the story. It establishes a worldview for us. Where did we come from? How do you tell the story of where we came from? And particularly, is the story of where we came from a story that's governed by purpose, or is it a story that's governed by impersonal, non-purposeful forces? And so our culture is often advocating a non-purposeful, impersonal origin of the world and also of the earth and of human life. And there, and so why do you exist? Just because. The biblical story starts with purpose, a divine purpose. But it's not simply where do we come from, but it establishes who we are. As human beings, we have an idea of who we are established for us in Genesis as humankind made in the image of God to rule the creation on God's behalf, to rule the creation with wisdom and benevolence. I'll be talking more about that tonight. I could talk about it tomorrow, but you won't be there for it. But as you start telling that story, if you're a good reader of Genesis, one of the first things you realize, especially in the first two chapters, is that your life doesn't match what you read about in Genesis 1 and 2. It's not as pleasant, not as sunny, and the nice breezes and all the rest of it. And so Genesis 3, namely, something's gone wrong, so part of the telling of the story is not simply where do we come from, but also what's gone wrong, and is there anything that God or other forces are doing about it? And if they are, how far along are they in the whole unfolding? And where is the story headed? So the Bible is setting out for you this grand overarching story, and it invites you not simply to believe the story, but to be a part of the story. So that you're a part of humanity, even I'm a part of humanity, believe it or not. You're a part of humanity, but you're also a part of God's purposes in the world. We'll come to the issue of redemption in a moment. But also, what you do now makes a difference. The shape of the story from here on out makes a difference what you do in relation to it. So your life is meaningful. It's a purposeful story, and your life is meaningful. That's a fundamental human need. You might contrast that with the story that one of which I'll talk about this evening from George Gaylord Simpson. Man is the result of a purposeless and natural process that did not have him in mind. And how would you lean into the world if that's the true story of the world? Well, I think you might agree with Macbeth. After Lady Macbeth has committed suicide, I'm sorry if I just spoiled the story for you, but and he talks about life is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury that signifies nothing. And certainly, if George Gaylord Simpson is right, that is the story the story of the world is a story told by an idiot, and it means nothing. Pastor Rayburn at the beginning of the service prayed about how we want to live lives now in light of what we will wish we had lived on the great day. What we do right now matters. It makes a difference, not simply for ourselves, but for others. We are called to be the vehicle of God's blessing to the rest of the world. So the story you tell makes a big difference on the way in which you address yourself to living in the world. Now, of course, the Bible also, by introducing Genesis 3, tells us that you have an initial creation where you have God saying it's all good and he's happy, and you have the setting up of the marriage relationship of the man and the woman, and so everything's supposed to be great after that, but you have Genesis 3 in which they disobey. Bless you. In which they disobey, and as a result of their disobedience, things start to happen to the rest of the world, particularly their Adam and Eve and their descendants are cast out of the garden, and they're not allowed to return. And then you see immediately in Genesis 4, you see bad things happening, namely in Cain and Abel. You have a murder being committed, and then you have, a little bit later, the family of Lamech, who is just an atrocious human being, boasting about his sevenfold vengeance and so forth. And so, the only way you can make sense of that story is of those tales within the larger story is to suppose that what you have is an initial good creation, but it has been damaged by human sinfulness. And what you see in redemption, in God's activity for the sake of humankind after that, is to recover the proper functioning of our humanity. We call that the image of God. And that isn't just about how you as an individual function, but how you function in relation to God, how you function in relation to a community, how you function in relation to the world. That's God's purpose for Israel. And so you see repeated the idea of be fruitful and multiply that was said to Adam. It's then said to Noah, Abraham and his children are promised that God will make them fruitful and he will multiply them. So that what you see in redemption is God forming a people in whom he is reestablishing the image of God, the proper functioning of their humanity, so that that people will be his vehicle of blessing to the rest of the world in whom this redemption hasn't yet taken place. So in the Christian era, you have Gentiles being brought into that because it's predominantly Israelites in the ancient era. And the whole show is going to a place where you have the triumph of God's purposes. That's something to which we look forward. So that's the nature of the biblical story. You can see that Adam and Eve fit into that story at least in a very broad stroke picture. And, it could be a matter of discussion how finely drawn we want to make that picture. I'm happy to engage in those conversations. But also in something like this, again, I'm trying to win people rather than to yell at people. So I'm willing to carry out the rhetorical exercise that's called concessio ad argumentum. That is to say, you make an allowance for the sake of the argument. We'll give you that, but let's see where it goes. And that's why I say I'm not overly concerned at this point about how finely drawn we need to have all the particulars of the story. But rather, what you need in order to make sense of the world, the function of the story is to enable you to make sense of the world. Okay, so why do you have within yourself contradictory desires? Why do you feel free to say that desires that you have within yourself are wrong and they don't belong not only in you, but in others? Because there's some standard by which you measure them, but you also feel that it shouldn't be this way, that there's something askew about the world that shouldn't be this way. And so by feeling that, you're tapping into the notion, the Christian notion of the fall. You have the beginning of a good creation, you have the distortion of the creation, and you, as an heir of that, you feel that distortion and you want something done about it. So your most basic human experiences then are experiences of being a human being who has this two-sided nature, that you wish you were better, you're not, and you wish somebody could do something about it. And of course, the other aspect or two other aspects of your daily experience, I hope anyway, is that all human beings share these same features. So whether they're black or white or Oriental, American Indian, you name it, we're all like that. And so there's this common origin for the human family. We can actually call ourselves a human family. And then also there's something distinctive about human beings, that whatever might be the relationship between us and the chimpanzees, and you get estimates of how how many percentage points our DNA differs from them. You know, supposing, let's just suppose, see, this is the concessio ad argumentum. Let's suppose that what some people say, namely about 1.5% of our DNA differs from that of the chimpanzee. Let's suppose that's right. That's controversial, but let's just suppose for the moment that's right. What a difference 1.5% makes. Because we speak and they don't. And again, I'll be talking more about that tonight. You can have a marriage between people of different ethnicities who are human, and the products of that marriage, the children will be image bearers. It's an atrocity to think of any kind of marriage or something like that of a human and a chimpanzee. It's something horrifying to us, and nothing comes of it other than further horror. So these are features of our regular experience. And so if you ask what kind of story should we tell to take account of these features of our regular experience, you want a story that accounts for your uniqueness, the human uniqueness in relation to the rest of the animal world, and that includes human responsibility for the rest of the animal world. You want something that accounts also for the commonality of human beings, and also that accounts for this sense of displacement that we call the fall. The Adam and Eve story in the Bible fits that to a T. It's the perfect front end for the entirety of the biblical story, the Adam and Eve story as it's traditionally understood, namely human beings start from a special creation of God, and the special creation of God is what explains why we're different from everything else. In Genesis 2, the man is formed from the dust of the earth, and the other animals are also formed from the ground. So there's a lot of similarity. The word for it's called a living soul. That's one translation, or a living creature, I think, is the usual English translation. It's used in Genesis 1 of all kinds of animals, and it's also used of human beings. So there's a sense in which we share lots of properties with the other animals. I mean, we live in a body. These are matters of common observation. We live in a body. We eat. We breed. We et cetera, et cetera. So we have similarities, but the differences are what really stand out to us. And we're not just another beastie. And somebody who tells a story that indicates that we're just another beastie is not telling a story that accounts for the things that you and I actually experience. But we're not simply a special beastie. We're a beastie with special capacities and also a special problem, namely sinfulness. And unless you understand that story, then you don't really understand the nature of redemption. Why would God form a people for himself? Why would he give them this elaborate sacrificial system? Why would he send his own son to die for the sins of his people and to rise from the dead, and then commission his disciples to go and bring this good news to the rest of the world? Because this is the true story of the world. So this is the argument that I've made, and so it requires that you have Adam and Eve there at the front end, and we traditionally call them our first parents, and that's fine. Well, I gave my paper in 2009 making that case, and as a result, I wrote this book, Did Adam and Eve Really Exist? Who They Were and Why You Should Care. Then, as a result of writing that book, which I never had in mind to do, but it's just what happened, I was invited to participate in this particular forum, Four Views of Historical Adam. And I kept trying to say historical Adam and Eve, and all that stuff got taken out by the editors. I'm sorry, but I do actually honor and respect all the ladies and mothers and all that sort of stuff. So sorry, it's not my fault. I think it's important to clarify that. So here you have four guys. I don't know why we had to be guys as such, but that's just the way. I mean, that's demographically. If you think about our ages, we're all four geezers, actually. So you're not going to have from our age bracket the availability of other than guys, for women who are going to be asked to do this stuff. Denny Lamoureux, who's a Canadian, and teaches in Edmonton. He's a biologist and also a theologian. And he represents the view that Adam and Eve never existed. He embraces fully an evolutionary perspective. He's not evolutionary in the sense that Richard Dawkins is, because he says the evolutionary process is a purposeful one. Then you have John Walton of Wheaton College. John argues for what he calls archetypal Adam and Eve. And what that means is that you have an actual Adam and Eve, but they don't need to be right there at the front end of the human story. They're just somewhere along the way. And John is happy for them to be way downstream from the actual beginning of the human race. And what they did is an archetype or a pattern. Then you have myself, as I'm classed as the older creationist in this group. I prefer to say the issue of the age of the earth is not theologically important to me. And I don't think it should be to you, but that's another discussion. And then Bill Barrick of the Master's Seminary is the young earth creationist. Bill actually uses, most of Bill's arguments come out of this book. I mean, he says so. So I don't know that he and I are actually at odds. All four of us became friends in the whole procedure. You don't think of people in the context of conflict becoming friends, but we did. You're always, when a person's your friend and yet you still have to say in public that your friend is wrong, you know, it makes it harder, but you have to do it. And we all accept that, and we all, each of us thinks the other three guys is wrong. If I have to describe their views, I'll try to be fair, but I'll also have to show you why you shouldn't accept them. The chief defect, say, of Denny's view, the fully evolutionary view, is that it doesn't account for the fallenness of humankind, the original good creation that has been marred by the fall. Denny's argument is that we have, I believe in the resurrection of Jesus, that's what's important, let's stop arguing about this. Well, there is a sense in which that's a fair thing to say, so we'll stop arguing about whether Denny's a Christian. But the question is whether the story Denny's telling is really adequate for the generality of God's people. So much as he's my friend, I have to point out to you that I think it's inadequate. Then John Walton is arguing, he's not arguing for or against any evolutionary questions. He doesn't think the Bible speaks to those things. But he does think that Adam and Eve show up in a genealogy in Genesis 5. Somebody's descended from Adam and so on. So he thinks that we should do justice to that, but we just don't need them at the front end of the human race. And I can't understand how that would work. If you have them way downstream from the beginning of humankind, how could their sin and disobedience, how could that legitimately be attributed to people who aren't really connected to them, who aren't related to them by descent? That seems to me to be unjust on God's part. Then the major dispute between Bill Barrick and myself is the degree of literalism that we'll use in interpreting Genesis. Not a question of whether the account is historical, but just how literally should you interpret it. So that's the case that I have made. My own assessment is that in the long run, at least amongst theologians, the likely outcome will be that John Walton and myself will be the ones to whom people will, that they'll be drawn to one or the other, because the other guys just come off as too extreme. I'm not saying whether that's good or bad. I'm just saying that's my sociological take on what's likely to happen, and just my assessment in talking with other theologians. And so what I want to stress with you then is that this is not simply a debate about whether two people existed. Just because they're mentioned in the Bible, I mean, it's important that the Bible says that they're there and they existed. But that's not really the main focus. The main focus is what kind of story are we telling? Is it a story that accounts for the experience, the daily experience of yourself and everyone else? Is it a story that exhibits the divine purpose for not just the world, but for your life? And is it a story that invites you in to be a player in how it transpires from here on out? And so the front end of the story becomes of enormous consequence then for that kind of story. So it's not one of those things that you can say, let's quit arguing about that, we have bigger fish to fry. No, actually, this is one of the biggest fish in the sea that we need to, and we need to fry it properly is really the proper response. All right, I'm going to stop there and see what kind of questions you might have. Yes?
So you say it's the big picture that matters, it's the story. What would you say directly to the claims that you referred to earlier? You say the genetic evidence seems to indicate that, you know, we could not come from
just two.
Is there anything you say?
Right. Well, there's several things to say about that. And so you have to decide what your... I just might not, the way you said that, So, his question is, what do I say about the genetic evidence that you can't start with just two? There's several things to say about that. Part of it is, I'm not with those who say, well, that's just, the unbelievers. They just do that and they're just projecting their unbelieving worldview and we don't go for that. I think there is no call for that sort of thing. My interest is in what's a strategy for reaching people, for bringing people along. So yes, all Christians prefer that we have a situation in which the initial population is two, husband and wife, and we'd like to have some reassurance that the scientific evidence supports that. I mean, so all Christians should feel that way. You feel that way, right? Okay. He sat in my classes, and I could never tell because he's got this Teutonic mien about him, and so you could never sort of read him. The thing about the genetic evidence is that it changes, or the reading of the genetic evidence changes. From the time when Francis Collins wrote the manuscript for The Language of God. To the time it was published, he'd already changed his mind about certain things in the argument about the so-called junk DNA. So shortly after the book was published, he was saying that he wished he hadn't made this point about junk DNA because he no longer agreed with it. So, things change in the scientific discussion. Plus, the calculations of the numbers are based on certain assumptions. Those assumptions ought to be controversial. I've talked with some biologists who are sympathetic with evolutionary studies who said, yeah, probably the number's going to go down. They don't think it's ever going to go to two, but the point is that it's going to change. And so then the question becomes, what do we do in the time being? First of all, it's okay to live with a little bit of tension. Between what we profess and what seems to be the majority position of people in the sciences. It's okay to live with a little bit of tension there. And it's also okay to say, look, I want to get it down to two, and I would like for the scientific evidence to show that, but even if it doesn't, it still matters that we all come from the same source. And so we still insist that we have a unified human origin and a special creation of humankind. So, again, as an argumentative strategy, that is the approach that I would take. All right, other questions? Right here, yes.
The thing that rung my bell the loudest was skipping over the agingness of the earth.
Yeah.
The chronology question. I think it needs to be addressed. It's addressed from the beginning. And through the first chapter, we have it again in God's giving of the fourth commandment, where he talks about the day-date relationship. I don't think we should skip over it. I think it needs to be addressed up front.
So the question, just before Rick pounces on me, is because you were ready, weren't you? Yeah, yeah. So the question was in regard to the issue of the age of the earth. Well, that's another discussion altogether, I'm happy to engage in it. I'm just not going to do it right now. Since I've written on the subject, I will urge you to buy the things that I've written, I'll just leave it at that. But what I want to stress is that reading, the position you just articulated is a reading of the Bible. It is a reading that you began to try to warrant, so that's appropriate. But I would contest it, and I'll just leave it at that. So lots of people think that, lots of people think otherwise, and it seems to me that that's not the major issue when we're telling this overarching story. So that's the way I'm going to leave that, just for the sake of peace and tranquility. Dr. Darby.
Mm-hmm. Of God imparting His, us being created in His, and with His nature.
Right.
Some things are evident in the way we behave and act, but there's a sense in which there's a spiritual embodiment,
mm-hmm.
not a good word, but
right.
a spiritual impartation of something divine.
Correct.
So is that do you see that as a valid argument in apologetics? That
yes, I do. So again, the Rick DeMass policy here. So he's arguing that the whatever genetic markers we're looking at don't actually indicate the things that actually distinguish us from the chimpanzees, the things that are distinctively human. Is that a fair way of putting it? And I think that's correct. That's a point that C.S. Lewis made, that the human mind is something that cannot be explained simply by a material process. Even genetic development isn't enough to explain what we have in the human mind. That argument has been taken up actually by an atheist philosopher, Thomas Nagel, in New York City, where because he's an atheist, he says, I don't want to go where people like Alvin Plantinga have gone. Alvin Plantinga has also taken up, a Christian philosopher has taken up that argument. Nagel said, I don't want to go where he's going with his theism, but I have to agree that materialism isn't going to get the job done when it talks when we talk about the human mind. And so when we in our popular culture, when people talk about evolution, they're talking about a purely material process. And the thing about that process is that it's not adequate to account for you and me. It's not, our genes matter to us a lot, but they're not all that we are. Yeah, so this is a very good point. You always make good points, so that's good. Yes, sir. Okay, so we're off to a good start.
Yeah. But you make some comments on dealing with folks that don't necessarily agree with you. And if you read the history, especially of the Presbyterian Church in the last 100 years and all, there has been a trashing of Scripture. And you read the accounts of Machen certainly saying that liberalism ultimately is a problem.
with hypothetical Christians. I used to be real involved with the CMDA, Christian Medical Society, that there's a point where there seems to be falling off, and it's simply a matter of not a misinterpretation, a misseeing of the scripture, but simply a matter of belief, unbelief. How do you deal with that? You've got liberals that you certainly would say are truly off the edge.
Okay, so boy, Rick, that one's going to be a hard one to compress into a short. Yeah. So he wants to come back to the issue of worldview when it comes to the interpretation of various things, not simply the scientific evidence, but also in the way in which it applies to the Bible. Would that be a good summary? Well, that's right. That's why I think the approach of C.S. Lewis is the right one to use. Namely, you address people in terms of their actual ordinary day-to-day experience and ask them what is the story that actually accounts for that. And so that's how you speak to a person as a person, and you try to have them reevaluate the story they've been told. What often happens, what I've discovered in my own peregrinations and misadventures and so forth, is that the idea of the Bible as supplying us with an overarching story is one that is not often enough inculcated in God's people. It's there in Machen, it's there in Warfield, for example, but oftentimes, if we're conservative, it's a set of beliefs that we hold. And it's almost as if those beliefs don't have a proper relationship to an unfolding story. And on the liberal side, the idea of a story seems to be an irrelevancy. And it's just about me and my soul and so on. So I think that the bigger thing is to take people back to the issue of what is a story that's adequate to account for the things that you and I actually experience, and we know we experience. And don't you dare deny it, or I'll think you're lying. I mean, you know, that kind of stuff. So that's I think that's how you address, as a general rule. Obviously, okay, so you have colleagues, and I have colleagues, and so on, and each of them is a unique person and a unique relationship. And so some people can take a little bit more cajoling. Some people can take, you know, a little bit more, well, you know, let's sort of start asking some really basic questions here. I've seen that latter approach then bear some fruit. I'll just put it that way. Right here, yes, sir.
You've said that probably most evangelicals will end up either in your, roughly in your position, roughly in Walton's position, and you suggested that you have a struggle thinking about how would it work for in a Walton system for God to be just for these archetypal people to end up being adequate representatives of us if they're later downstream. And I'm not familiar enough with Walton's arguments to suggest what he's saying, but supposing that the ensoulment that Paul Darby is talking about happens with just a single pair out of a pool, and then you go from there. What do you find is inadequate? Because I think it seems to me that Walton could have all of the story that you're pointing to, and you're saying we need a story that tells us this and this and this. It seems to me that Walton would be able to retain most or all of the features of that story, but still be disagreeing with you. So where can you explain more where your differences?
Okay, so you're asking for more explanation on the differences that I have with John Walton,
right.
And in particular to the theological subject that we talk about is the imputation of Adam's guilt. I mean, that's what it boils down to, right? Is that what you're asking?
Well, that may be a part of the answer.
Well, yes, I am trying to shape the question in order to get us to the answer, you know, because. You ask the question, but I get to give the answer. All right, so that's the arrangement we have here. you know, in terms of human history, we have the humankind developing, you know, somewhere in the Middle East or some people say East Africa or whatever, but somewhere in that part of the world, and then spreading to cover the globe. You have them spreading into Europe, into Asia, off to Australia, here into the Americas, and so forth. And so, you know, you have the human family dividing into these various groups. And so if you have, after these migrants have gone their separate ways, one of the branches is where Adam and Eve occurs. So how is what they do legitimately attributed to the whole when the whole are just all over the place? That's the basic problem. So, for example, I exist as an American citizen because of decisions made by people in northwestern Europe that led them to this continent. So I am the heir of those decisions. That's all very legitimate. Okay, so, you know, my grandparents and great-grandparents came to this continent, and so we don't have a difficulty with that. Where we would have a difficulty is supposing my grandmother had stayed in Ireland, and her cousin had migrated to the United States. You know, what would be my relationship to American citizenship, supposing that supposing I existed, obviously it's going to break down, but supposing I existed, what would be my relationship to American citizenship? It would be none. And so that's the difficulty with John's view. He does not really account for the fact that we are heirs. That we're inheritors of what Adam and Eve did. So inheritance is the category. So I inherit things that are true of my forebears and of my proper representatives. And so what's the propriety of somebody who, you know, is in a parallel stream to mine or parallel branch to mine? What's the propriety of that happening? So that's the difficulty. And John doesn't have, I mean, I've asked him and he doesn't have a good answer for that. So I don't know what, one of these days I have to stop. But did you have a question?
Loved your book. I taught it to my kids.
Okay, you may talk for a while then.
What was so exciting, and thank you so much for your ministry, because you show us that Christians can have science. It helps me in my worship. I have two sons now that are college-age students in the science world. You get to have the freedom of saying, well, this is what is true, because you're Dr. Collins, and the scientist academia is not paying your bills. I have students. What wisdom could you give for Christian students who are in science and how to navigate that?
Right. So what would I say to students, to Christians who are students in the sciences or practicing in the sciences? And I've actually had a conversation with the head of evolutionary biology at a major East Coast university, and he said to me, look, the origin of life is something that for which we do not have a natural explanation. Okay, so I mean, we just know that, and all the hoo-ha that's out there about that is just that. I mean, it's people trying to get money. So that's a frank agreement. So this is coming back to your question as well. I mean, look, humans are different. Okay, they just are. So he's sure that we share a genetic component with other animals, but there's something been added to that. He's totally clear on that point. And that, I think that's actually a fairly common position amongst people in biology. It might be harder in other disciplines, psychology, because psychology tends to be dominated by people who want a purely materialistic or naturalistic description of human beings. So it's, but you just come back to what we all know is that we're different. In something like cosmology and physics, astronomy, it's easy to talk about the Big Bang as the origin of the cosmos, and there is no natural explanation for where the Big Bang came from, which is what the majority of cosmologists acknowledge. So that again, you can sort of decide what's the big fish to fry, and what's the stuff that is just not necessary to get into, and that's the strategy that I would encourage. You're very welcome. Okay, so Rick, you need to stop me when I'm supposed to. One more. Okay, you get the last one. Let's make it really good.
Oh,
Oh, I'm sure it will be. Mm-hmm.
And where that comes from.
Right.
And C.S. Lewis used the words ought, I ought to. Where
yes.
does that come from? And so are you saying then that your evolutionary biologist person, I want to know, how does the unbelieving atheistic community address that question? Because the mm-hmm. enfoldment we think of as being mm-hmm. morality, the image of God, being the moral mm-hmm. nature of things.
Right. So how does the I'm just trying to keep to the time here.
So answering Connie's question,
yes.
you were saying that
yeah.
your evolutionary biologist friend
right.
was saying, we don't know. We're different, but we don't know.
Yes.
Is that their answer?
Okay, so the question is, how does the unbelieving evolutionary community address these questions of genuine morality and genuine human distinction? Is that okay, so, and one of the things to appreciate is that this evolutionary biologist that I had a conversation with said, we don't want Richard Dawkins to be our spokesman. And actually, so most people in biology wish Richard Dawkins would shut up. Okay, so that's, so when we talk about a community, we have to be very careful. We mustn't see him as the acknowledged spokesperson for the entirety of the disciplines of biology. And again, I mean that's what he says, and I have not taken a survey to know whether he speaks for everybody. But what we should appreciate that there's a lot more diversity amongst people who practice in the sciences than there is in the publicly anointed spokespersons. That's the first thing. Second thing is most people, not the spokespersons, but most people will acknowledge the reality of moral obligation, and the spokespersons will try to wave their hands and divert your attention from that, but most people, I think, that's the place to go, so that we recognize, and even if they say things that are moral, that we don't agree with, so you know, in terms of in recent developments in this country regarding same-sex relationships and so forth, we are not considered too moral in relation to our culture. We're considered immoral in relation to our culture. So what that means is that our culture is appealing to a morality that we're obligated to comply with. So, and even if we don't agree with the specific content of that morality, at least they have that same intuition. And so we can start there and work with people there. I'm going to stop there, and thank you.